I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one is a last look at the presidential election campaign of 08. Could you describe it in the phrase that our guest James Fishkin uses to define democracy as the voice of the people when they are thinking? If you didn't know who was going to win, how would you rate this process we've just been through? Nearly 2 years of polls, primaries, debates, ads, jokes, skits, YouTube excerpts and parodies, blogs, coffee shops, infomercials, the multi-millions of dollars spent, the long arc of a contest that lands, in the end, on just a few battleground states. The youth mobilization, the rock stardom on both tickets. What's right, what's wrong with this picture of a free country picking its chieftain? Professor James Fishkin at Stanford University has planted a critical alternative model in many minds, and he's made it work in Europe, China, Australia, sometimes in this country. He calls it deliberative democracy. What if each primary state, what if the whole country had stopped the music for a day of deliberation before the campaigning began? What if citizens had their own face-to-face means of thrashing out their choices? James Fishkin, welcome to Open Source. I'm looking for a report card on our democracy in practice, but give us first that deliberative democracy perspective.
Well, from the standpoint of deliberative democracy, we aspire to a system where that represents everybody under conditions where they can think. Where they can think about the issues, think about the alternatives, become more informed, principally through face-to-face, principally through dialogue with those they agree with and those they disagree with, and those who, in a safe civic public space. And we experiment with this, both face-to-face and online, with scientific samples representing the public. I should step back and say that our system, the American system, was born with an aspiration to fulfill deliberation. But it was deliberation initially by the elites. That is, Madison, in his scheme for the Constitutional Convention, for the Constitution, preparing for the convention, and in the Federalist Papers, Madison and Hamilton, Publius wanted representatives to, quote, refine and enlarge the public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens, unquote, as Madison said in Federalist 10. And the whole idea was that people would reason together about the public good in relatively small face-to-face groups, the Constitutional Convention, the Senate, the ratifying convention. Even the Electoral College in its original form was supposed to be a deliberative body. We now have the leftovers of this system, and like an appendix or a vestigial organ, it sometimes breaks in the sense that it doesn't conform necessarily to the popular vote, and it leaves out a large portion of the public, all those who are not in swing states, crimping our dialogue and crimping political participation. Now, it's interesting to note that this system of elite deliberation was partly born out of fear of popular participation. There had been Shay's Rebellion, and after all, going back to ancient Athens, the people had killed Socrates. And so democracy itself was a controversial notion. They didn't even use the term democracy. They used the word republic in describing what they aspired to. But step by step, power has shifted directly to the people. With the anti-federalists, who had a referendum in Rhode Island, which was the only state to vote down the Constitution, as you know. And then with the progressives, which brought about really the shape of our current presidential selection, candidate selection process with the mass primary. And then you've got the development of technology, television, radio, television, the internet, and which permits a mobilization, but also even more discussion among the like-minded. with current technology. So you've got a lot of defects. So we bring democracy to the people, but not under conditions where the people have much effective motivation or opportunity to think seriously about the choices before them. So the result is a kind of soundbite democracy where we exchange messages that are often about the content of fortune cookies, and with the incentives for manipulation, and distraction, we're stung by we're literally sound bitten by the stinging sound bites, and those sound bites and the practice is a kind of practice of that I would say is literally MAD, M-A-D, mutually assured distraction. And the mutually assured distraction outlines the long road we have taken, which has culminated in this election, a road that we have taken from Madison to Madison Avenue. That is, Madison Avenue is the method of persuasion, and the same techniques, the focus group testing, diometers, science of audience response, the hocus pocus of various kinds of emotional attractors, has been that we use to sell soap or automobiles, applies to the selling of candidates. That's a general structural situation. Now we can talk both about this particular election, and we can talk about ways of possibly making the system work better by at least the criteria I would spell out is better.
Well, we'll do it all. Let me say you're no slouch when it comes to bumper stickers and slogans yourself. I mean, from Madison to Madison Avenue, I like it. But go back to the Founding Fathers for a sec. We have such mixed feelings about them. Geniuses all, incredibly creative, visionary, brilliant men, but we're always reminded that they're a bunch of white guys, a lot of them slaveholders too, thoroughly flawed. How do we mix that, the intelligence of the Federalist Papers, with the mass mobilization that is part of our code now?
Well, the mass mobilization was not part of their picture at all.
Exactly.
As I said, they were initially fearful of democracy, but the anti-federalists said that those privileged landowners and elites were rich and unrepresentative of them. So the anti-federalists said, where will there be a blacksmith? Where will there be a farmer like me? And so they didn't like the small size of the Senate. They wanted direct involvement. And that culminated, as I said, in this very interesting event in the state where I think you're situated, Rhode Island, where the anti-federalists said, well, everybody's freedom's at stake in this new constitution. We'd like to vote on it. And the Federalists said, oh, no, that would be an unprecedented mode of consultation. I describe this a little bit in The Voice of the People, you wouldn't be able to hear all the arguments. You could hear all the arguments in a convention where everybody could get together and argument could be answered by counterarguments. So the anti-federalists said, well, we'll hold this referendum in town meetings where we can discuss it in each town in Rhode Island. And the federalists said, oh, no, that's no good, because the town meetings by the shore will have different issues than the town meetings inland. The rich towns will have different issues than the poor towns. And you'll never, unless you get everybody together in one place where arguments offered can be answered, you'll never be able to really consider the reasons for and against. So what happened is the federalists boycotted. The anti-federalists voted down the Constitution, and there was a crisis, and which was only resolved after Connecticut threatened to invade from one side and Massachusetts from the other, and under threat of force of arms, Rhode Island said, "Okay, we'll have the required constitutional convention," and they ratified the Constitution, and thus democracy was born. And Here is this little studied and noticed, it's certainly not taught in the schools, event in American democracy, a little bit parallel, I think, to what recently happened with the European Union.
I was just going to say.
And Ireland deciding to vote down the Constitution in referendum, where, because this shape of the EU is roughly parallel to the shape of the Articles of Confederation, where any state can really offer a kind of veto. And so I don't think there's any chance of the British and the French invading Ireland, but the problem remains. The problem remains that they're in a constitutional stasis. But they're in a constitutional stasis because they're caught between this basic, fundamental democratic dilemma. Europe is caught in it. We are caught in it, where you either have a deliberative or somewhat deliberative democracy of the elites, or you have a non-deliberative democracy of the mass public. And the non-deliberative democracy of the mass public can be whipped up by plebiscitary passions. I think the Irish voted down the EU partly as a protest over the high petrol prices, which was not directly relevant to the EU issue at all.
Well, we'll come to that. But I was just going to say, I mean, don't the Irish, doesn't any constituent state in a system like this have a right in a democratic game to put it to a vote, put the measure to a vote, and say no?
But the question at issue was, I don't dispute. In fact, in my writings, I really support three fundamental political principles. One of them is mass participation. One of them is political equality, so everybody's represented equally. And one of them is deliberation. The trouble is it's very hard to get all three at the same time. And what the Federalists were saying was that the mode of consent should be indirect via a convention who would have the sort of cool reason to consider the competing arguments. But the referendum or mass participation is often subject to being whipped up by some kind of a particular issue that will catch the public's mind. Plebiscitary democracy has its limits. And let me say a reason why. One reason, social scientists later had an explanation for this. Anthony Downs called it rational ignorance. That is, if I've got one vote in hundreds of thousands or millions, of course, Rhode Island only had about 70,000 at the time, which was indeed the same number as ancient Athens, 60-some thousand. The point is that if I've got one vote in a large number, and now, of course, you know, we may have 130 million people vote on Tuesday. If I've got one vote in millions, why should I spend the time and attention to become really informed about the issues because my individual vote, my individual opinion, won't make a lot of difference? And I've got other things to do. I've got to do my job, provide for my family, etc. Would that it were be otherwise. That is, we would like citizens to become informed. In fact, the whole presupposition of democracy is that people will be sufficiently informed that their choices will be meaningful. And so the problem is to create conditions under which we have an informed and engaged public worth consulting. Now so much of our efforts are directed at mobilization, just getting people to turn out willy-nilly, whether they know anything about the issue or not.
But hold it right there, Jim. In California, referendums are more popular than ever, it seems, as a way of resolving policy, and they also, at least on paper, invite people to stop and think, talk to each other, consider, without the distraction of personalities, and vote. Remind us what's wrong with that, in your view.
Well, referenda out here, the initiative we're living with the optimistic legacy of the progressives, with referendum, initiative referendum, and recall too. As we saw with the election of Schwarzenegger. The problem is that, mobilized interests create strategically chosen ballot propositions, often competing propositions that are just slightly different, designed to confuse the public. And there are quite misleading advertising campaigns that this takes us to Madison Avenue rather than Madison, that are designed to pick out some little bit of information out of context so that people don't get a balanced account of the competing views. And so the same campaign techniques that apply to elections apply to referenda. And it also paralyzes the representative process in the legislature, who have more and more of their purview turned over to referendum processes.
Jim,
it's a very imperfect form of government.
I want to come back to a critique of what we've just been through in 08, but would you just give us first a notion of how deliberative democracy has been applied by you in all sorts of places? I'm particularly fascinated with the consideration of wind and alternative energy in Texas, of all places. But you've done it in Europe. You've done it in Australia. You've had English people arguing or deliberating over membership in the European Union. Give us one case history of how it works.
Okay. Well, a fairly simple case. I'll start with the one that you said you were most interested in. So back in 1996, we began a series of what I call deliberative polls in Texas, where there was a requirement for what the Texas government and Public Utility Commission called integrated resource planning. The electric utilities were supposed to consult the public in some way about their energy planning. How were they going to do this? One way of consulting. And then they were supposed to, you know, file plans as to how they were going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to solve the state's energy needs based upon, in part, this public consultation. So if they took polls, they knew the public was not very well informed about electric utility matters. In fact, very interestingly, they didn't know this, but some years earlier, a famous political scientist named Phil Converse had discovered so-called non-attitudes or phantom opinions with a question about electric utilities. That is, the public often, when it doesn't know, doesn't have an answer, hasn't thought about a question, nevertheless will give an answer because it never likes to admit it doesn't know. So they will randomly choose an alternative. And that was the case in a series of questions about electric utility matters, phantom opinions. So I was very attracted to the notion of supplanting phantom opinions with considered judgments.
Okay.
So in any case, in the Texas case, the electric utilities had the problem that how are they going to consult the public? If they did polls, they would get a significant amount of noise because the public hadn't thought about the issues. If they did focus groups, they'd get real discussion, but focus groups are very small, 8 or 10 people. They are demonstrably representative. If they had open meetings, they'd get the organized interests and the lobbyists. They wouldn't really get the people. So we had just done a big nationally televised deliberative poll on PBS with Jim Lehrer in Austin, Texas, as it turned out, with the presidential candidates in 1996. It was called the National Issues Convention. And as a result of that, the utility companies approached me about doing deliberative polling because they would scientifically represent everybody under conditions where they could think. So at first I really wasn't much interested because I didn't want to do anything with commercial companies. But then I realized that that this was an opportunity to influence public policy. So I set a bunch of conditions. We got an advisory group of all the stakeholders who were relevant to the choice. And this was easy because these were all the stakeholders who would usually comment on regulatory proceedings, the environmental groups, the consumer groups, the advocates of alternative energy, the large customers, the advocates of each kind of energy, coal, wind, natural gas, et cetera, the advocates of the poor customers. We got all of those together to form an advisory group, and they had to agree on the briefing materials didn't have to agree on what should be done. On the contrary, they had to agree that here are some major alternatives, and here is accurate information about arguments for and against those alternatives. With that briefing document, we did a questionnaire of the same kind you'd do for a good public opinion poll.
Right.
And then we went out and recruited a scientific sample, and then we popped the question. After we did the survey, we recruited the people to come. We paid them something. We recruited local PBS to broadcast it in the service territories. And we got the public utility commissioners themselves to participate answering questions, as well as panels of competing experts who nobody gave speeches, but they would answer questions from the sample that the people had developed in the small groups. And then we saw the changes in opinion in a final confidential questionnaire. And this, you know, several hundred people in each of these things representing the areas.
And what did they choose? What was that? What was their
verdict? They chose very, very shrewd combinations of renewable energy, wind power principally, and natural gas, and investments in conservation. Natural gas was clean, and at that point cheaper than it is now. Although I guess it's become cheaper again. But they approved natural gas, which is, and amazing was that the companies and the Environmental Defense Fund were on the same side at the end. They both could endorse the results as reasonable. And so each of the eight electric utilities in regulated electric utilities in Texas did a deliberative poll, filed an integrated resource plan, and each committed to larger and larger investments in renewable energy. Principally, the Davis Mountain is now filled with wind power. As a direct result of these plans that were filed, and then as a direct result of a renewable energy portfolio that was based upon our data, which the initially skeptical Pat Wood, who was chairman of the PUC, a Republican appointee from George Bush, used that data to lobby the legislature to make sure that Texas, that those preferences, considered preferences of the public, would continue to be taken into account. So Texas, I guess about 2 years ago, surpassed California as the leading state in wind power. I think Boone Pickens has a plan that would double it again. But right now, as a direct result of these public consultations, by the way, over the eight projects, it's very interesting. The percentage of the public who were willing to pay a little more on their monthly bill in order to support renewable energy went from 50% to 84%, averaged over the eight projects. There's similar results in terms of investment in conservation. There were also big investments in conservation because people initially wouldn't know that conservation, or sometimes called demand-side management, that is lessening the need for more electricity, can be very cost-effective. And so there were big investments in that as well.
So the short form is that deliberative democracy, as you played it in Texas, actually builds windmills despite the oil prejudice or whatever, and it gets results. It also strikes me that, is it fair to say that you're operating on something more like trial rules with evidence and expert testimony and that sort of thing than you are in the style of personal brawling that we've come to love in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. Although we've shown that the process of the deliberative polling process works better than a jury, because juries actually have some problems in terms of the push for consensus, and we get our information at the end in confidential questionnaires, the same questionnaires with which we began. But yes, people thought initially I was tilting at windmills, and I ended up building them.
All right. Listen, that lays the groundwork on deliberative democracy. Now, from that perspective, and your cards are on the table, I'm looking for the Jim Fishkin review of this long, fascinating process of 08. What do we like about it? What do we regret about it? What could we change the next time?
Well, in some ways, as I say, I have three values: participation, political equality, and deliberation. So in some ways, it's the best of times and the worst of times. Worst of times, I'd say some of the most irresponsible political ads I've ever seen were this on this election cycle, like the ad that McCain had, which he put his name on at the end, saying that Obama had only one legislative accomplishment, which was teaching sex education for kindergartners, which, of course, was a total distortion, not of a bill that he introduced, but he did vote for, but it was one that was designed to protect kindergartners from sex predators rather than teaching them about sex. And so that's an example of the kind of manipulative, misleading soundbite campaign that can be terribly destructive. Mm. And in an election year that was less serious than this one, it might well have had an effect. Obama, I think, went over the line with some ads about how McCain was really in Florida was really going to privatize Social Security, which falls far short of what he McCain's position. And I think the overwhelming there's not been much deliberation about the two big events. In fact, they've been incredibly non-deliberative that have basically determined everything. The going way back, the initial event was the Iraq War,
yes,
which provided the opening for the Obama a big part of the opening for the Obama candidacy. And remember, that was sold with an advertising campaign and a misleading campaign about weapons of mass destruction and connections to Al-Qaeda, which and 9/11, which large portions of the public still have not been disabused of.
And which might have been flushed out by a deliberative process, even United States Senate hearings.
Yes. So I think that about which there's an abundance of evidence. So the non-deliberative prelude, which was a big condition for the initial part of the campaign, was the Iraq War. Now, the big thing now is this financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question you get in answer to an election, the answer you get in an election depends on the question the people are asking. Now, sometimes candidates are successful at manipulating an election by priming an issue. By priming, we mean you make a particular issue dimension the most salient and important one, and that becomes the criterion that people evaluate everything on. And so I think actually the 2004 election may have been successfully manipulated at the end by Osama bin Laden, who made an appearance right before the election in his golden robes, as you remember. I think it was the Friday or Saturday before the election. And it made terrorism again, it primed terrorism an issue, which I think influenced a lot of votes. Now, candidates can prime elections, but events can too. And this financial crisis has made made the economy the prime playing field for the election, and that is a terrain that is favorable to the Democrats, and that's the overwhelming reason why I expect Obama to win on Tuesday.
But you're right. Can I just agree that it's a non-deliberative big factor in the race? The discourse about the economic crisis, I think you'd have to say, is unreal. We talk about a catastrophic position of national debt and now credit failures, but we're somehow going to spend our way out of it. We're talking about a smaller government that bails out Wall Street and General Motors and the biggest insurance company in the world. There's something fundamentally irrational in that discourse.
Well, yes. In fact, look at the $750 billion bailout. The campaign dialogue has not connected with any of the real policy alternatives.
Exactly.
And indeed, the campaign, the $750 billion bailout was posed as the need to buy up toxic assets. And in fact, very quickly, partly because of the example of Gordon Brown, the strategy has changed completely.
Yes.
So the government is buying non-voting shares and preferred stock in banks. And whether that is going to – and now that turns out the banks aren't spending the money, they're using it to buy up other banks and to provide a cushion.
Yeah.
So we're launching on the most extraordinary expenditures without real consideration of the policy alternatives. And that dialogue, whatever it is, among a few policy elites, has not penetrated the campaign. So the campaign discussion about the economy focuses on who's going to cut your taxes more and focuses on earmarks, which are a tiny part of the budget. So there's an unreal there's a disconnection about the crisis that's going to. But whenever there's a complicated issue, voters decide based on certain shortcuts. The technical term is heuristics. If there weren't a crisis, sometimes they decide on the shortcut of who they like the most or can't personality traits. But there's another shortcut that's very commonly used, which is, I think, which is invoked if things are going especially well or especially badly. And that's called retrospective voting. Hmm. That is, it's the very simple calculation. If things are bad, you throw the bums out. And if things are good, you keep them in. And right now, things are bad. So yesterday in Florida, Obama said, with Clinton next to him, look, there are two economic theories. There's the Clinton method, which I endorse. We tried that for 8 years, and you remember what happened. Then there's the Bush method, which McCain would continue. And now look where that's brought us. So do you want the Clinton plan or the Bush plan? I was surprised at the way he endorsed the Clinton plan, but nevertheless, he was trying to make it really simple. We had one period of 8 years of prosperity, another year period ending in disaster. So do you want more of that or not? That very simple calculation. Now, that's not, as we've just seen, the actual complexity of the policy alternatives has never been broached in this campaign. And that's the thing that the public cares the most about. But it's very hard to reduce it to sound bites and to overcome the incentives for rational ignorance, particularly at a moment when we're building up to a culmination, which is going to be as much mobilization as deliberation. It's going to be who can get their own people out to the polls.
Can I go back to something interesting you said a moment ago, Jim, and that was that if it hadn't been a rather serious election and a serious tenor to the whole thing, some of those demagogic smears might have worked. Interesting question why they didn't, but I think it has to be noted that in some strange way, though we heard sort of flirtations with demagoguery, racism, sexism, those lapses were confronted. And the spirit around this campaign, with the first African-American contender, the first female contender of real moment, has been, the general tone has been anti-racist and anti-sexist. It's kind of kept it. There's been no Willie Horton ad that got real traction in this campaign,
right.
It seems to me.
Right. I think that's because of the economic crisis. I think the 527s were preparing to tune up, but they haven't made an appearance that was taken seriously. But there still have been some, as I said, some irresponsible ads. But I think the change in tone with the beginning of the financial crisis was caught for me by a headline on the Huffington Post that said, "Goodbye lipstick, hello economy." I think that people realized that all of a sudden the public wanted answers. But they've been given very simple answers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the irony is, by the way, when we do our deliberative polls, we find the public, if you give people, ordinary people, a reason to pay attention, they're very smart collectively. They're able to deal with immensely complex topics. It's just normally they don't have much reason to pay much attention. They don't have a safe public space in which to exchange information. And they talk, so they end up going about their business without thinking too much or investing too much in politics or public affairs because there's not much they can do about it, and they don't think their voice matters.
I want you to go back to your fundamental criteria of democracy and the matter of mass participation. There has been an extraordinary mobilization, especially of younger people, so far it sounds like, and African Americans and Latino Americans. How does it rate on your standard of participation?
Sure. We'll probably get, you know, more than 60% turnout as we got in the in 2004, which of course is less than the 65% or so, I guess, that we got in when John Kennedy was elected in 1960. But notice we have this, we're crippled by the iron cage of an 18th century design. The Electoral College means that, I mean, right now I think there are about 13 states that are in play, at least according to the Politico map, and that's probably about right. And we earlier had maybe 18 states. Even an expanded map going way back, you might get 22 states that might be potentially swing states. Mm-hmm. So that leaves 28 states, 30 states, 37 states that are basically out of it. You know, we're not campaign battlegrounds. We don't get so all of those people are not engaged. They can give money. They can migrate temporarily to other states to work if they have jobs that are flexible enough, or they're unemployed and they can take time off. Let me tell you about a little dialogue I had in China about this. We did a deliberative poll in China at the local level where we actually used it to make decisions and the about what infrastructure projects to build in a city in China. And the party elites thought that the public would like all these image projects, superhighways and a fancy town square. Instead, what the people wanted was sewage treatment plants. They wanted clean water, an environmental plan, and a people's park for recreation. And they got exactly what the deliberative poll was meant. So what was offered. So it was, in a way, without party competition, a perfect realization of deliberative democracy at the local level, of course, only at the local level. So we had this big fancy banquet with the local party leader at the end celebrating it. And so he turned to me and he said, see, through a translator, we don't need your Taiwanese style fake assassination party competition democracy. I said, well, I think party competition would be a good idea for your democracy. And he said, no, we don't need it. He said, look, even in your own country, he said, does your vote count? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, and this sort of took my breath away because I had no idea he was so well informed, but he really was. He said, do you live in a swing state? And I said, I live in California. Is that a swing state? He said, I said, no. And he said, where'd you live before that? I lived in Texas. Is that a swing state? I said, no. He said, see, your vote doesn't count. And then he said, is your congressional district gerrymandered? And then I was really flabbergasted. And I said, well, I don't know. I think it probably is gerrymandered. So he said, see, your vote for Congress doesn't count either. But here we implement your ideas perfectly.
He's got half a point and he got a very sophisticated take on us.
Yes, yes. So I said, well, we do have this problem that we have this 18th century trap of geographically defined units, both for our congressional elections and our electoral college, where we don't have proportional representation, and it's winner take all by and large. And so as a result, some people just get left out. I think the Electoral College is indeed a destructive legacy of an earlier vision of democracy that was a compelling vision in its own terms, but it's completely different in its operation now. So from going back to your question about participation, the participation of many people in most states is not going to be engaged or informed in most states, the election by state is going to be a foregone conclusion.
And that lowers the score on your criterion of equality too, right?
Yes, both political equality and participation. A lot of people are just left out, and it's because of the structure of the Electoral College. See, I think we ought to change the Electoral College, and people say you never change the Electoral College because the small states would never give up. You'd need a supermajority to get enough states, and the states that have power now would never give it up. And I say, in every red state, there's a blue constituency, and in every blue state, there's a red constituency of people who now don't have their votes counted. And if you actually mobilize those people, there would be a constituency. And we ought to have – see, just imagine, suppose you had direct election, probably with some runoff provision, but suppose you had a direct election. Then every vote would count in every part of the country in the same way.
Right, right. That's another point. I mean, just a thing to be noted, it seems to me, that we're a little – got to be troubled about in 2008, that we seem to have accepted this red-blue formula, even though Barack is – you know, made his stand against it 4 years ago. But we seem to have accepted a polarized country that must remain that way. Friend says this election comes down to a question of which America will elect its president.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Right. Well, I think it's a problem that's also exacerbated by developments in the media. So on one side, you have Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, and various ways for people on one side to get the information that they will find congenial. Then you have MSNBC with Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow, who, you know, do a good job at what they're trying to do. But you've got various the Huffington Post. You've got various websites that tilt the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of attempts at extensive balanced reporting are under siege. The New York Times stock today, I think, is $9.
From?
You know, major news organizations that have a stake in reporting their business model is taken away partly by Craigslist and partly by internet advertising. And which can go to highly partisan sources. And given the polarization in American society, it's much easier to consult news sources you agree with, and much easier to have conversations with people you agree with. Then if you disagree strongly with somebody about politics, it's a lot easier to discuss the weather than to have a serious discussion, which is why when we have deliberative democracy, we try to create a safe public context for people to talk to each other. And they find that quite appealing.
Yes. Two more big questions for me. One, the economic crisis is going to present 1,000 questions to be undertaken in a deliberative way. How's it going to happen? Are we going to have congressional hearings, Senate debates that will really open up the substance of this mess we're in? Are you thinking of alternatives? Where do we go with that monster issue, urgent in millions and millions of most people's lives, and a better process?
Well, I don't know. I certainly, with various partners, we're certainly trying to seriously explore doing deliberative polling, deliberative democracy projects about these topics, because they have been incompletely deliberated at the elite or the mass level. It's probably the case that that without a divide, that we get more serious deliberation when there is divided government, but we may get more concerted action with united government. And I think we're certainly going to have united government, whether we have 60 seats in the Senate, whether the Democrats have 60 seats in the Senate, I don't know. But whether the same party is likely to control the Congress and the presidency. And so hearings may not be the I think everybody benefits from considering competing points of view. But I'm interested in involving the public in real consideration of the trade-offs. After all, it's the public. The public that we take scientific samples of the public and bring them. See, the Federalists were right that you need a relatively small face-to-face body. They were wrong that the people couldn't do it. So it's a matter of institutional design, which is why I've taken this notion, which really goes back to ancient Athens, of a deliberative microcosm chosen by lottery or random sampling, who would deliberate on public issues, sometimes make public decisions. By the way, we do it online as well as face-to-face, so
What's
we can
address?
Save a lot of money. cdd.stanford.edu, Center for Deliberative Democracy. Just Google Center for Deliberative Democracy. But by the way, we returned Athenian democracy to Athens, as you know, through the help of George Papandreou, where we used it in the Athens metropolitan area for candidate selection for the Socialist Party in Greece, PASOK. So the Financial Times wrote it up as returning Athenian democracy to Athens after a gap of 2,400 years.
Let's bring it to the Athens of America and spread it around this country. I got one last very general question. We love the notion that the U.S. Constitution is God's will and that our country is the last best hope of earth, a light under the nations. But imagine a big, ambitious, wannabe great country out there, Brazil maybe, or Indonesia or China. If you were Brazil, would you be wanting to copy or adopt our presidential campaign as you've lived it in 2008?
Well, first of all, Brazil gets great credit for having a combination of compulsory voting and electronic voting machines that actually work. So in some ways they may be ahead of us. Although I'm not sure about the compulsory voting, I could see the argument on either side. But at least they get very, very high turnout. Now I do think that our system, with its fixed terms and this very complicated 18th century structure, has saddled us with, right now we've lived through a presidency that's ending in 25% approval ratings or so, the lowest, below Nixonian levels. And as a result, in any other system in the world, that head of government would have been replaced. Instead, we had to live out all 4 years of the second term. So there are definitely disadvantages to the structure of our system. However, there are advantages in terms of the variety of alternative sources of power the opportunity for experimentation at the state level, the laboratories of democracy, and the room for innovations that can bubble up from one state to another. I do think that our presidential selection process is irrational. As it becomes more and more front-loaded, it moves more and more into the realm of a national primary, and a national primary puts a premium on fundraising and name recognition, and makes it much harder for issues and candidates to emerge. I think Obama, Kerry, only emerged because of the Iowa caucuses, which was a kind of quasi-deliberative moment with a relatively small number of people who participate, and which has been less susceptible to the dark arts of manipulation but I think the Iowa caucuses are irrational too, because I mean from the standpoint of whether they represent the rest of the country. So I would have liked to I would like to start off a deliberative microcosm chosen by lottery before the official primary season starts. That's what we did with PBS with the National Issues Convention. It's just we didn't do candidate preference, but we got a lot of presidential candidates to participate.
It would be very, very interesting to see if a deliberative process of citizens could set the agenda, you know, before the candidates or the established media, for that matter, the news magazines, whatever, television, could set it for us. I have to draw this to a close. I just want to say, I mean, it seems to me almost no matter who wins on Tuesday, this will be remembered as the Obama phenomenon year. And just that alone, in so many dimensions, has reestablished the notion that almost entirely for good, American politics at the presidential is a place where, when the brakes are right, anything can happen. And that's been hugely refreshing, it seems to me, to the whole idea of a country finding its way, it's a new way, with an old process. Am I right or wrong?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's openness to innovation, unpredictability. I do think that the campaign, for all its defaults, for all its faults, has been somewhat more substantive than in the past. At least we're free of the 527s the influx of new energy by the internet has changed things dramatically in terms of fundraising and mobilization, and has allowed for new forms of political participation and new ways for people to become informed. And that is all to the good.
James Fishkin, I don't know if this is deliberative, but it surely is interesting. It's a great pleasure to hear you on Open Source, and I hope we'll do it again. Thank you, James Fishkin, at the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University. Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Please post your own report card on this 08 presidential campaign as an exercise in democracy. How was it for you? Leave a comment on our site at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.